I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Raven Gray. She's a visionary writer, educator, and activist. A permaculture designer for over 15 years, she's a pioneer of the Transition Towns movement. In 2007, she founded Transition US, a nonprofit that inspires the emergence of resilient communities that can thrive in the face of today's environmental and social challenges. Raven holds a BA in Culture, Ecology, and Sustainable Community and a Master's of Science in Ecological Education. She lives in the Point Reyes National Seashore, Northern California. So first, thank you for being on the program, and second, thank you for your work.
Thanks for having me on the show, Derek.
So the first question is, what is the Transition Town movement?
Okay, well, let me just begin by saying that I live on occupied Coast Miwok territory, which is their ancestral lands in Northern California, which is now a designated national park, known as the Point Reyes National Seashore. I like to, you know, pay my respects to those people that lived here peacefully for thousands of years, and also the animals that once inhabited here, the grizzly bears, the black bears, the tule elk, the wolves, the antelope, all of which have now been sadly exterminated by white colonial settlers. And so I like to also pay tribute to, you know, give thanks to the, not so much the people that live here, but the animals and plants that live here, like the bobcat and the river otter and the red-legged frog and the osprey and the coho salmon and the blue whale, the bishop pine, and all the other living beings who I know here by name and who I hold dear in my heart. And everything I do, Derek, all of my work is driven by my deep love and respect for these living creatures, all of whom are under threat and being killed by our industrial civilization. So, with that, how... You asked me a question about the Transition Town movement, right? How did I get involved, or what is it exactly?
Yeah, what is, and presume that people in the audience will be sympathetic, but they may not know anything about it.
Sure. Okay. I have a lot to say about this, and there's a lot to cover. So, what is Transition Towns? I can't really speak about Transition Towns without speaking to permaculture, because the roots of transition are grown in the soil of permaculture. And I first got my permaculture diploma, which is a design course, a two-week design course, in 2001, which was the very first earth activist training held here in the Bay Area with Starhawk and Penny Livingston. And I've taken at least 5 permaculture diplomas since then. I've been a teacher in the UK and in the US. And permaculture, you know, I understand that I'm giving you the definition of permaculture, because transition towns are really a social permaculture. It's permaculture applied at the community scale. So permaculture, which is difficult to define in a nutshell, I'll give it a go, is a regenerative design system or science that meets basic human needs. By that I mean food, water, waste, shelter, energy, etc. And it solves our basic human problems, by which I mean pollution or excessive consumption, while at the same time enhancing ecological health. So it's permaculture's relational approach to design. It's based on deep observation of the natural world. It looks to see what does nature do here and seeks to enhance the diversity of relationships between things in a system, whether it's a human system or, you know, a growing system, a food system, or an educational system, because that's what nature does. And nature is intelligent, she's efficient, she's complex, she's incredibly abundant and giving of herself. So, you know, other examples of permaculture would be, you know, perennial polyculture, food forests, or composting toilets that use human manure on the land, because basically our waste is black gold in terms of nutrients, and we shouldn't be flushing it down the toilet with water. So permaculture also has a set of guiding ethics which help it in the process of making good design decisions. They're called Earth Care, People Care, and Fair Share. So that's the care of the earth and all living and non-living things, care of people. And Fair Share is referring to equitable distribution of things like labor, resources, money, and skills. So it has social justice built into it. And my mentor, Penny Livingston, used to say, it's the cutting edge of a 10,000-year-old technology. In other words, there's nothing new in permaculture. It's common sense based on thoughtful and protracted observation of the living earth. It's about relearning how to become native to our place. And there's a bucket load of tools and practices that integrate traditional ecological knowledge with modern, small-scale, appropriate technologies, so-called, using them to try and solve these seemingly huge and intractable problems created by industrial way of life, which brings me to the subject of permaculture and cultural appropriation, which is not something that many permaculturists talk about, but I think it's important because, you know, typically permaculture is described as being founded by two white guys, two Australians, Bill Morrison and David Holmgren, But it really has its roots in the practices and wisdom of Aboriginal cultures, particularly Tasmania, which is where Bill and David studied, and whose knowledge they basically borrowed, or some might say appropriated. So most of what they learned came from Indigenous peoples, and I think it's really critical that we acknowledge this legacy and acknowledge where permaculture ideas and practices come from. Otherwise, we run the risk of practicing what I've heard called permacolonialism. So an Indigenous people look to nature herself for their knowledge, and therefore the true founders of permaculture who deserve our respect are nature herself and the Indigenous First Nations Aboriginal peoples around the world who learned how to live in a good way within the limits of their land base. And I'm going to get back to transition in a minute, but just let me add that permaculture at its core is about reconnecting people to the land, to each other in a circle of reciprocity. So in other words, in permaculture, we give back more than we take, and we take only what we need. We tend the land and each other in a way that supports and enhances life for all living beings, not just ourselves. So it's more of an ecocentric than an anthropocentric worldview. And for me, it's really a radical spiritual practice. I think it gets to the roots of how we're meant to live on this earth with each other. And I've heard it described as revolution disguised as gardening. And I think if you take it on and really fully acknowledge where it comes from, its roots, then I think it is, or at least has the power to be revolutionary. And on a personal note, permaculture pulled me out in the year 2001 from a very deep, dark depression. I'd been working as an activist, gosh, since I was like 11 or 12, growing up in the Thatcher era in the UK. I was on the front lines of the poll tax riot, which took place in England, and a lot of other animal liberation front. I was very active, you know, and I was just done with the world. And I really feel like permaculture and the Earth Activist training gave me, you know, the tools and the inspiration to get back and rejoin the fight. And so after I studied the EAT, as it's called, I went back to the UK, because I was in the Bay Area. So, and I went to live back in West Cornwall, which is the tippy southwest end of the United Kingdom island, because that's where my ancestors are buried and where I consider my ancestral home. And I tried to set up a kind of Earth Activist Center for myself, for my community, a center of ecological education. And while I was doing that work, and that was 2004, when I came across this guy, Rob Hopkins, who was at the time studying at the Hollies Center for Sustainability in Ireland. And I had learned through him about this radical new community permaculture design project called the Kinsale Energy Descent Action Plan, which drew heavily on Richard Heinberg's power dam work. And Richard, I had studied and mentored with Richard Heinberg for a number of years here in the Bay Area. So I something just clicked for me with this. It was, you know, as soon as I saw that design project, I thought, wow, this is it. You know, this is a tool for collective community action, regenerative design, applicable at any scale across the globe, and we're going to change the world. And I wanted to be part of that, you know. I honestly thought it was going to work, which is perhaps naive in retrospect, but I still do see its potential. And so I was so excited. I was completely on fire. And so I wrote to Rob, found out he was moving to Totnes in 2006, which is this very small market town just a few hours away from where I lived, and that I heard from him that he was planning on taking this design process, and instead of it being a sort of in-house permaculture design project, he was going to engage his entire community in the design process. So I took the train to meet with him upcountry and worked to follow in his footsteps and in Totnes's footsteps, and implemented the transition design process in my own community, which, although was not a town, I have to say, I lived in a very economically depressed rural farming and fishing. I was farming at the time down there as well, and it's a horribly depressed region of about 60,000 people. It's known as Penwith. So I founded Transition Penwith, which was the world's official second transition initiative. And it launched 2 months after Transition Town Totnes. And I certainly wouldn't call myself a founder of Transition Towns, but I would definitely say I'm a pioneer. I'm an early adopter who helped grow the wider transition movement through my own efforts and, dare I say, mistakes. And the thing with the transition movement, which I think I've said a little bit already, is that, like permaculture, it doesn't really have a founder. Although Rob Hopkins is certainly a very charismatic leader in the movement, he deserves recognition for his vision and immense body of work, and he's also a very humble and very kind and good man, and he's the embodiment of engaged optimism, which means, you know, he has a positive spin on everything. And I don't, but I love him for that. And, you know, there's some other people who contributed to the Transition Towns movement. Let me just name them because they don't often get named. And that is Louise Rooney and Catherine Dunn, who were the two female students in Ireland who actually coined the term Transition Towns. And they were the ones who also developed the original Kinsale Energy Descent Action Plan. And then there's Naresh, who put together Transition Town Totnes with Rob, Sophie Banks, and the Transition Network members, and all of the transitioners around the world really are building and founding this movement. And to reiterate, it's critical that we acknowledge the true founders of the transition movement, which exist beyond and beneath all of these people and beyond permaculture, and that is the lineage and lifeways of Aboriginal and Indigenous people from whom this knowledge is birthed. So today, I'll tell you a little bit more about what transition actually is and how it works, but let me just say that right now, as of today, there's it's 8 years old. It's a very new movement. It's a growing movement. It has 1,100 transition communities in 47 countries. There's 11 official hubs and 12 more hubs developing in different countries. Those are like the organizations that support the movement within their country. And one of those is Transition US, which I founded in 2007 when I first moved back to the Bay Area from the UK. And even though those are just some stats, I'd have to say that the ideas have spread, you know, far and wide beyond those numbers. That, you know, when I talk to people about transition, certainly in the environmental movement or the social justice movement, pretty much everybody has heard of Transition Towns at this point. Okay, what was I going to say? What I'm going to say is, I hope I'm not talking too much, Derek, or too fast.
No, no, that's great.
I can tell you what I love about transition, how it works a little bit, some good things that came out of the movement.
Well, before that, can you sum up what is the Transition Town movement? What you've done? Can you give like the final two sentences on summing up what it is?
Yeah, I could. It's really hard to do that, as with permaculture. It defies definition, but its intention is to create a low-carbon, socially just, healthy and happy place to live and work. That's what the Transition Networks, that's sort of their statement that they say on their website. It's a radical relocalization movement. It's a movement that catalyzes the people in its community to come together in the face of change, and by that I mean climate change or economic instability or, you know, any number of crises that are hitting us right now, and to build, you know, a more vibrant, abundant place to live where local livelihoods are supported, where we're connected to each other and our families and the land. You know, it's a movement that to build a community for ourselves where we're not reliant or less reliant on fossil fuels, you know, where we're all involved in creating a plan for what we want our community's future to look like. You know, it does have some ingredients and some patterns and processes and principles that guide it. But it's supposed to, like permaculture, the solutions grow from the place itself. You know, it doesn't have a model particularly. It's not like one size fits all and this is how you do it and this is what it is. But it does have these guiding themes, if you like. I mean, and then it has a process of sorts. Let me tell you what that is. So it starts out, say you want to do transition, and I forget where you live, but the place where you live. It starts out with a small group of you decide to get together and say, right, we're going to make a change. We're going to, you know, get our community to be more resilient in the face of change and less dependent on the carbon extractive economy. And so you might start off by organizing some awareness raising events. You might do some reskilling events. That's reskilling is there's something in transition called the Great Reskilling, which is essentially a reversal of the Great Deskilling that's been taking place in the last 200 years. You know, Rob Hopkins likes to say we're the most useless generation that's ever lived, that people just don't know how to make things or do things for themselves anymore. I know my grandparents did, my mother not so much, and me even less. So these reskilling events are held all over the world. They're very, very popular in the transition movement. And they're basically skill sharing, you know, things around, well, everything you can possibly imagine, really, as long as it's small scale and appropriate low carbon. So, you know, I'm talking about natural building, local economics, food growing, seed saving, grey water, rain catchment, composting, fiber arts, backyard chickens, I mean, herbal medicine, all kinds of things that you can imagine, that skills that would help you get away from the mainstream economy and do things for ourselves. And it's a strategy for building community resilience. So when you're starting out, you might start doing these reskilling events, and then you might get a practical on-the-ground project going, like we did in Penwith. We re-established the community farmers market, which had gone under. Or, you know, I think one of the early projects of Transition Town Totnes was to put nut trees all around the town so there'd be food for everyone, free food. After you do, you know, you never really finish these processes, but after you're involved, you're doing some events, you're gathering awareness, you're bringing people in, then you might connect with local businesses, nonprofits. You know, there's an expression in the Transition Town movement that, you know, don't reinvent the wheel. So look around and see what else other groups are doing and ally with them, whether that be schools or the elderly, the youth, local governments, and other kinds of transition groups perhaps that are in the broader region. And then you start to build out your transition group. And that can be, well, the intention is to catalyze the relocalization of your local economy. So it's looking at all sectors. So in Transition Penwith, we had a transport group, an energy group, a food group. We looked at water and waste. And, you know, all of these areas had their own, they were sort of decentralized, self-governing units that were looking at, you know, where are we at now in terms of food? You know, can we grow what food we need to in Penwith, or do we have to rely on outside imports? Is it possible to be, you know, fully sustainable in terms of food? And the intention of these groups is to be, you know, much bigger change agent. It's not just community gardening groups. We're trying to change the paradigm that we live in. And the work, one of the outputs of the work is creating an energy descent action plan, although I've heard them more recently called community resilience plans. And that's usually a 20-year vision for your community, looking ahead of where you want to be and then using imaginative visioning tools and practices to imagine what you would need to do to get there. It's called backcasting. So you look at where you want to get to, what's your ideal vision of the community, and then you do an assessment of where you are right now in your community in terms of, say, the food sector or the food group, and then you look at all the steps you need to get to that vision, working backwards. So, you know, that involves, transition groups typically involve forming social and cooperative enterprises and, you know, strategic local infrastructure where the community owns its own assets. And then there's another stage that's beyond that in the transition movement. It's called daring to dream, which imagines stepping up the transition thinking to a national level where a new culture of transition could be catalyzed. So that's how it works. Is that clear?
Yeah, no, it's very clear. Thank you. And I live in Crescent City, which is, what, 3-4 hours north of you? No, probably 5-6 hours north of you. And we actually have, even though it's a very small town and very conservative here, we actually have a transition town movement here.
Right.
The person who's primarily sort of the motivating factor here, one of the things he's doing is he wants to do a lot with fruit trees to help, like you said, with the nuts, and then with nut trees. And then also he's really big on helping people and getting people to think about exiting the larger economic system. And he's also very big on attempting to help people to exit the wage economy and to enter local, as you said, skill sharing, local bartering. This from my small experience of transition town people, he seems fairly typical of many of the ones that I've met who is working very hard on those particular directions.
Great, I'm very glad to hear it. I mean, there's lots of things. At some point in this conversation, I'll get to a critique, if you like, of why I feel the movement lacks teeth. But, there's lots of really wonderful things about transition. And I still, even, you know, thinking about it in preparation for this interview, I was like, there's so many beautiful things in it and so many great people that are really committed and enthusiastic and, you know, willing to put their oar in and try and make things happen in their communities. I mean, Some of the things I really love about transition is that, you know, just it brings people together. I mean, that it builds community because it brings people together in fairly different ways and connects people in ways that are, you know, friendly and fun. You know, it likes to be celebratory and, you know, inclusive. There's this idea of the power of just doing stuff, which is also a book that Rob Hopkins wrote, I think, last year. And that people just, you know, the premise is that people simply need to just get on with the work, however small, and that all of these changes will add up to make a big difference in the world. And that, you know, that's a very empowering and enticing vision. Who doesn't want to get on board with that? You know, it pulls people in. People like to feel like what they're doing is useful. You know, they want to feel good about what they're doing. And, you know, Richard Heinberg once said a few years back that the movement is more like a party than a protest. And, you know, people like to party. They like to celebrate. And if you make people feel bad about their life and doom and gloomers, you know, and their lifestyle's terrible and they feel shame and blame, you know, they may not want to get involved and get on with the work of being a change maker. So this, you know, this above all, you know, transition is really positive, optimistic, hopeful, joyful even.
Which
so
is
all of the things that I'm not really, actually, that's not the core of who Raven is. So
well,
it's quite refreshing to me, you know.
That's I'm glad you put it that way, because the local fellow, he and I have talked a fair amount, and we've had, you know, he's interviewed me a bunch of times. I've spoken to the group a couple times, and
great.
It's all great. And I, he is very positive, and he's a very, you know, he's exactly what you're describing. And then one of the things that I will tease him about is that it feels, I'll say how much I love the sustainability movement, and then I'll say how much I hate the sustainability movement.
Right.
And and it's always very clear that this is like, you know, getting upset at your brother or something, you know, that this, or getting mm-hmm. upset at a family member, that this is not, I'm not attacking them at all, but instead it's the disagreement that one would have, you know. It's like, I can say bad things about my brother, but if you do, then those are fighting words, sort of thing. that it feels to me sometimes like, because of the whole party, not protest atmosphere, it can feel very not threatening to the dominant culture, which is, after
right.
all, killing the planet.
Yeah, I'm definitely on that side. Mm-hmm.
And so I guess that's a segue to, I mean, you've made very clear your profound and deep love and affection for this, both permaculture and the transition movement. And in that spirit, can we move now to some of your concerns and perhaps either disappointments or things you would like to see changed, or however you want to put it?
Okay, yeah, sure, I can do that. I mean, can I just say a couple more positive things?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, please.
I really want to just get that out of the way. Because like right. you, some of the things I say that are positive and that I love are also the things I hate. And so there's definitely a relationship there, because, you know, I don't remember where I was saying, but I was basically saying that, oh, yeah, because transition is positive, right? It's optimistic. It says we're facing these big crises, and what a wonderful opportunity to make a change for the better, you know? And instead of the usual green horror stories that we're all exposed to that make us feel so terrible that we don't want to do anything. And but there's some really, here's some other powerful things about transition. Is it's
wait,
really
wait,
about
wait.
The power.
Can I want to say
yes.
one thing about that whole positivity. And yes, I understand the opportunity for change, but what it feels like to me, I mean, one of the first thing you said was how much you love the land there and the non-human inhabitants. And,
yes.
you know, I guess that if one had, if one's family, if somebody burst in and was being an axe murderer, killing your family, I guess one could also say, wow, this is an opportunity for change. You know, I mean, there is this profound, I mean, right now the world is being killed, and I don't perceive that as this great opportunity for change. I perceive this as this terrible thing which must be stopped. And sure, there's an opportunity for change too. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
I mean, no, I'm in full agreement with you, which is why I love you so much, Derek, and you're so influential in my own thinking and my own life. And I tried to bring some of these things into transition, but, you know, and I still, despite what you're saying, I still feel like there's some pieces of transition. For example, the power, you know, of storytelling that, I know that sounds so new agey, but really, that, you know, that new stories, when we share our stories, when we share our stories of deep pain as well, it actually brings us closer together. And, you know, I think that the storytelling piece that transition brings, it can, you know, it connects us to our grief, and it can, and that to me, well, that connects me more deeply to the courage and the strength to fight back. So I'm all about, you know, I'm all for sharing stories and creating new stories and using the power of our imagination and visioning. However, I mean, well, let me finish this. Here's the piece that really gets me, actually, is that transition welcomes everyone. You know, in theory, it says there's no them and us. We're all in this mess together. Let's just put our differences aside, find the common ground, and work together to find solutions to our shared problems. I mean, don't we all want clean water, clean air, healthy food? You know, it sounds very simple and doable when we frame it like that. And so, you know, that's why it's, you know, it's, I don't know if you know, but it's typically, or it's traditionally, I mean, it's very much apolitical. It doesn't campaign against things, it only campaigns for things. It doesn't allow for the divisiveness of politics, you know. It looks beyond these things to our humanity, which unites us all. The rubbish truck is going by, can you hear it? It's terribly loud. I shall move out here. You know, because, you know, this is what Rob would say and other transitioners would say, was because of this, it gets under the radar because it's not explicitly anti-capitalist or leftist. And it just slips into communities and gets them to think about things, you know, by organizing community events. I mean, I love this and I hate that part of transition. It definitely is, you know, one of the things that bugs me the most. So shall we move into my critique a little bit here?
Sure, that sounds great. And I think, once again, you've made very clear how much affection and respect you have for the movement.
Good. I'm glad, because I do. I really do. I think there's some really powerful things in it, including the emphasis on the inner transition, which is, you know, it's not so much, I mean, it's the emphasis on, yes, we've got to do the outer work in the world, but we also have to work on ourselves. So I'll speak to that for a couple of minutes, because I think that is important, at least for me, that the work we need to do on the inside is often overlooked, as an activist anyway, on the work we need to do in the outside world, because, well, anyway, I think those two inner and outer landscapes are intimately connected. And, you know, what kind of work we do, or what kind of work I did in my life, was deeply influenced by my psychological and mental health, you know. And let's face it, most of us in this culture are pretty unhealthy, if not downright insane. And so, you know, and our bodies, my body is horribly polluted with toxic chemicals. I've developed an autoimmune disorder, which is incredibly disabling. And, you know, I've learned to really work on decolonizing my diet and, you know, decolonizing my life. And with that has come a better state of health, which puts me in a stronger position to fight the good fight. And so, I mean, I also think inner transition isn't just about healing our own bodies and minds and helping each other out, work through the psychological aspects of change. But I think it's about dealing with conflict, you know, because there's a lot of conflict in this world. And yeah, sure, NVC is great, and other restorative justice circles or whatever's happening in the world right now. But I do think, as privileged white people, of which I am one, that we really have to work harder to challenge and transform, you know, the structural racism, sexism, classism that's living in our minds and hearts. And that, you know, the systems of oppression that we have in our institutional structures out there are also in us. You know, they're built into our languages that we use to communicate. And we have to dismantle these things on all levels, you know, to decolonize our minds and hearts. So I don't believe we'll succeed in creating this you know, sacred, sustainable culture. And that is the work of the resistance movement. And I don't think the transition movement takes it to that depth of analysis and action. Is that your experience in where you live?
Please explain what you mean by they don't take it to that depth. Which depth precisely?
The depth of understanding that there's a struggle and a, you know, a fight, a battle. There's a war happening, and it's a war against the living earth and the indigenous people and people of color and women. And, you know, there's a lot of fights and struggles happening, and I don't think that transition speaks to that. It doesn't and take it. It doesn't analyze it. There's no depth of analysis there or call to action. You know, I mean, it is a revolutionary movement. I think it's quiet. You know, it's. You know, I love this idea that we can do things for ourselves from the bottom up and organize together, and that we don't have to wait for governments to help us do it. And, you know, I do believe that small actions add up, but there's something missing in the movement for me, something that doesn't quite sit right. I've actually been puzzling over this for years and trying to figure out, you know, why is it missing for me? Well, for one, I was a frontline activist in the UK since I was 11 years old. And, you know, I'm also a rape survivor, multiple rape survivor. And, you know, I've also traveled across Southeast Asia, India, places like that, and worked, you know, in the front lines of, you know, sustainability or, you know, just indigenous cultures. I've seen globalization and, you know, for myself. And I've also, you know, lived here in the States for a number of years, the belly of the beast. And I listen hard, Dirk. I have a practice where I go out every day and I quiet my mind and I listen. I talk. I mostly listen to what the land is saying, what the trees are saying, you know, what... You know, what's the voice of the ancestors of this land and the animals and plants that live here? So I think that is why it doesn't really sit right for me, because I'm hearing that effing scream of the earth, you know? And it's mind-boggling how much, just in my neighborhood where I live in the Point Reyes National Seashore, where they're spraying Roundup, and the guy down the road just cut down his bloody redwood trees for no reason that I can see, you know? And because he wants a view shed, right? He wants to see the bay. So he's cut down the trees. And I've been there for who knows how long. And it just makes me, I'm crying. Like, I can feel that grief is so present for me. And, you know, I'm just not convinced that, you know, we can transform our communities and civilization as a whole without engaging in a struggle, you know, with the people and institutions that are just getting more and more power and wealth. I don't think those people and the power and the wealth holders exist. They have names and addresses, and I don't feel like they're going to give up these things without a fight. Why would they? They've got so much to lose. Why would they want to give that up? You know, and I don't believe that building a parallel infrastructure is going to work in the long term, you know? And I don't believe that transnational corporations or the big multilateral institutions, you know, or Monsanto or Chevron or any of the big ag, big pharma, big companies, big government, are going to just crumble and fall because we, the people, have made them obsolete with our radical relocalization efforts, you know? I just don't see that happening.
About, 18 years ago now, I was at a get-together, a whole bunch of activists and writers, farmers, got together in Washington, D.C. to talk about basically sustainable ag, what that might look like or whatever. And there was one exercise that broke my heart, and I've written about this, that at one point the facilitator said, so imagine that it's 20 years from now, which is now, and that we've achieved a sustainable way to live. So I want – yeah, which has really happened, hasn't it? And – he said, I want you to tell me what the community smells like, what it feels like, what it tastes like. I want you to imagine this sustainable community. And everybody went around and they were discussing, you know, it's like you said, nut trees, fruit trees, and you know, everybody's taking walks out through the forest garden. And I was getting increasingly agitated. And when they got to me, I said, this exercise breaks my heart because, A, you're not talking about how we get there in terms of stopping the psychopaths that are killing the planet, and, B, everybody in this room knows that if we were able to, in our community, find a way to be sustainable and then those in power found oil under our land, we know what would happen to our community, and we know what would happen to our land. And if we resist, we know what would happen to us. And for me, that's the and once again, you know, I really enjoy the local transition town guy. He's great. I think I have so much admiration for him. And one of the things I always say when I'm discussing this with, you know, the group or something, with a transition town group, is I always say I think the transition towns are necessary but not sufficient. And
That's perfect.
I feel like there's this great line by Kropotkin, where Kropotkin talked about how so many revolutions have failed because of bread. And what that means is that if people don't have food, they're going to go back to the system that gave them food. And the dominant culture gives us food, most of us. And that's one of the brilliant things that capitalism and civilization do, is they make us, and like any abusive system, what is the first thing that an abusive partner does to his lover? One of the first things he does is make her economically dependent on him so she can't leave. And it's the same with the dominant culture. Sorry to rant about this, but it's the same with the dominant culture, that capitalism makes us dependent. Why do people have to get jobs? It's because they don't have access to food, clothing, and shelter without the jobs. So Transition Town does a great job of saying, look, let's make ourselves self-sufficient for that, but then there's that next step. What are you going to do about the fact that there's already war been declared? Oh, there's one more thing I'm going to say, which is that, okay. Do you want to respond to that? If you want to respond to that, then I'll just either hold mine or forget about it.
No, I'll just hear you. Carry on.
The other thing I'm thinking about is, I keep thinking, and I read this in the Nazi Doctors back in 1992 or something, from Robert J. Lifton's great book, and he talked about how it was that the Nazi doctors, the doctors could work at death camps. And what he found is that many of the doctors actually cared very deeply for the health of the inmates, and they would do everything they could to keep the inmates alive. They would hide them from selection officers who were going to kill them. They would give them an extra scrap of food, etc. They would do everything they could except for the most important thing, which is to question the existence of the larger death camp culture, larger death camp itself. So they wouldn't question. And I think about that in terms of all of us as environmentalists, that we do everything we can to protect this or that piece of ground. We do everything we can except for the larger thing, which is to question the existence of the death camp culture itself, that's poisoning the world, that's gassing the world, that's starving the world. And so Transition Town, it feels – okay, I want to say one more thing, sorry. I did a talk at Bioneers 12 or 13 years ago. And the thing that broke my heart is that, so far as I know, I was the only person there who talked about either power or psychopathology. And I don't know how you can talk about social change without talking about power. And I don't know how you can talk about the murder of the planet and stopping it without talking about psychopathology. And so all of this, I'm going to shut up now, like one more sentence, that all of that is tied really to my concerns with the Transition Town movement. I think that's great. I think it's wonderful. And I don't know how you can talk about social change without talking about power structures and capitalism. And I don't know how you can talk about stopping the murder of the planet without talking about psychopathology. So now I'm done now. So you can talk forever now.
Well, yes, quite. I agree. I mean, I'm not convinced. A core tenet in the transition movement is that there is no them and us, that there's just no enemy, just well-meaning, wounded people. And I definitely don't buy that. I mean, if I talk to an indigenous rights activist on the front lines of a pipeline protest whose land was destroyed for the Alberta tar sands, they don't say there's no them and us. And if you talk to the people of color who live in Richmond just over the bridge here, whose homes and families are constantly contaminated by pollution from the Chevron oil refinery, I doubt whether they would say there's no them and us. I actually only heard that phrase, them and us, from well-meaning middle-class white folk, and I don't think it applies to most of the rest of the world. So for me, too, what's missing most in the transition movement is an analysis or a conversation about race, power, and privilege, and the understanding that a political resistance is necessary to make, you know, this transition to a more equitable world, and that I think this... You said this, or Leah Keith, or somebody said that resistance is not only possible, but considering what's at stake, it's imperative. I definitely fall in that camp. I know there's a movement within transition to address social justice and to look at these issues of, you know, race and power. And it's still very new. So, you know, my hope is, I actually was reading today on Rob's blog that there's a movement for transition in Mexico, and it has some successful projects, which I was pleased to see. One of the things they've decided not to do with this transition in Mexico is not to work with government, because guess what, you know, this would hinder their success, because it doesn't really work to work with local government when the government's corrupt and unbelievably violent. So they're just doing transition projects. The other interesting thing about Transition Mexico and the work that's doing down there is that they don't really call it transition. They don't, even the people that are doing the work don't really consider it to be transition work. They don't know what the transition movement is particularly. They call it Zapatismo. So, you know, that is a, I'm sure that all of the people involved calling it Zapatismo are very politically aware and actively resisting the dominant culture of imperialism down there. So is that, you know, is that transition in Mexico, or is it something else? Because, you know, that's political transition. Well, here's another thing I want to say, is that another ingredient in the transition movement is to let it go where it wants to. Let it go where it wants to, you know, just let it emerge from place. And this gives me some hope, because I think that the transition movement is great at reweaving community and bringing people together. And my hope is that it will continue to evolve and grow and build community and solidarity across difference. And then at some point in that process, people will wake up and figure out for themselves that if we're going to make a lasting transition, we need creation and resistance. That, you know, we not only need to create these local systems of food and housing that are equitable and just, but we actually need to confront and deconstruct and dismantle the industrial systems and the particular worldview that underpin them. So this idea that, you know, transition is apolitical, you know, how can we talk about creating just and sustainable housing or food systems without talking about power dynamics, which is basically what you just said? So, you know, I know it deliberately avoids, transition movement deliberately avoids that language. It doesn't want to look at power and specifically capitalism because, you know, it thinks that that would be a big turnoff to many people. And I get why they're doing that, but it doesn't go deep enough for me. It's not radical enough. I believe we have to get to the root of our problems. We have to look at our historical roots, you know, the roots of capitalism and colonialism and empire and patriarchy and all of those ugly words that would make everybody I know in the transition network shudder, and they'd move the other way. And that's probably why I'm more peripheral to the movement at this point, even though, you know, my heart is still there in transition, because I'm one of the people that inspired its emergence, you know. I'm one of the people that helped birth this movement, and I just want it to go deeper and into darker and more difficult places and to spread into the realms of, like, gender and class and, yes, you know, politics. Ah, you know, the words, I did a radio show last week, and I was on activism and resistance, and because I have a radio show here in West Marin, KWMR, and, you know, I looked up this guy, Frederick Douglass, and it's an African-American abolitionist and a former slave, and he said, you know, I've got a couple of quotes that I'd like to read. One is, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did and it never will. And he also said, it is not light that we need, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, and the earthquake. And that's who I am, Derek. I am the fire. And that's who I want to ally with, too. I want to be allies with the storm, the tornado, the earthquake that radically changes everything that's happening on the planet at this time. So I would say, you know, that the transition movement is it's an important part of the solution, which is basically what you just said too. I don't want them to disappear. I want this movement to succeed. I just like to see a little more teeth in the movement, a little more teeth and claws, more fire, more of a direct confrontation of power structures. You know, the trouble is that the people in the transition movement, as in permaculture, tend to be white, middle class, dominantly male, and we've all, you know, the people that are in it have benefited from this system of imperialism. They haven't experienced the oppression from the other side, and so, you know, we really need to get these people to wake up, you know, and become fierce allies for the people who have been oppressed, the people that have suffered the most. I don't really know how to do that. I don't know, you know, how do we bring the other voices in the room? How do we, you know, start to get, you know, not just the other voices in the room of the oppressed people, but how do we speak, you know, Joanna Macy style for the salmon, the wolf, the oak tree? Like, how do we do that without acknowledging this incredibly unjust system of white privilege and patriarchy? Because we have to name them. We have to name them, see them before we can dismantle them. And the people that are in those institutions, and I'm not going to give that up without a fight. So, oh, it's such an overwhelming task, isn't it? I was. Do you know who the Trapeze Collective are?
No.
They're a group of anarchist social reformers. They're really radical people that are in the UK, and they produced a paper which I don't have here on the transition movement. I had it here somewhere, but it's disappeared. But they said, you know, they have a saying, which is a play on words from Mahatma Gandhi, who said, first they ignore you, then they ridicule you, then they fight you, and then you win. I don't know if you've heard that before. Uh-huh. But the trapeze collectors said, first we were ignored, then we were ridiculed and laughed at, then when our ideas started to become really effective, we became a real threat and they defeated us. And that, you know, that's my fear with transition. It's under the radar right now. I don't think, you know, it's really a threat yet. Although I did listen to Rob. Rob Hopkins is presenting, he's put a publication together for, I forget what does COP stand for, COP21, the climate change talks that are coming up, you know? Do you know what that stands for? COP21?
No.
I don't either. But anyway, it's the United Nations thing. It's the United Nations thing that's happening, the big Paris climate change talks. And he put together a publication called 21 Stories of Transition, how a movement of communities is coming together to reimagine and rebuild our world. And it tells 21 stories of 39 transition projects in 15 countries. And it has, you know, significant measurable impacts. And, you know, it's told in the voices of the people who are doing the projects. It tells the story of their challenges and their strategies they're using to ensure their community resilience. And, you know, one of those projects, I don't know all of the projects, but one of them is to do with community energy supply companies, cooperative community energy supply companies. And there's a number of those happening now in Britain where communities get together, they buy their own solar panels, they, you know, they're powering their communities themselves, they own the energy company basically. But it turns out that they, because there's enough of them now, Rob just slipped this into his presentation. I wasn't sure, I haven't looked it up, but I was going to try and look it up online. But it turns out that I think he said, well, I know that he said that the UK government is now trying to push through legislation that makes that those kinds of projects become impossible. It hasn't gone through yet, but I guarantee that that's not a coincidence, that the UK government is putting that legislation through as a direct result of these transition groups. There's 400 transition communities in Britain that are trying to do, many of them are trying to do these community energy supply companies. And I guarantee it's becoming, it's got above the radar and it's been noticed and now it's going to get crushed down. So what are we going to do about that? You know, it's like that, we're going to have to fight that. I'm not in Britain, so I'm not going to fight it, but the people on the front lines over there are going to have to fight that. Anyway, I've probably said enough. I mean, I should speak also to, you know, I think Max Walbert calls it the Great Green Hope. I think that's what he called it. I saw his presentation at the Fertile Ground Institute on the illusion of green technology. And I've already read a number of publications about, you know, the dark side of green tech to, you know, to the point where it's not a solution. You know, the green tech industry is heavily dependent on the fossil fuel industry. And if everybody has solar panels and ramps up their green tech, it's going to be dead. Everything's going to be gone. It's not a solution. So I'm really, I just really wish that we were questioning these things more, you know? I mean, are we going to do something, Derek? Are we going to do nothing? I mean, are people going to get up and fight? Are we just going to all disappear in the sixth great extinction? I don't know.
Well, I think that that if there is any hope of people fighting back, then I think it will be in great measure because of precisely what you've been saying for the past 45 minutes. And I think it will be because in great measure because of people like you who are telling these stories and simply telling the truth. I think it's like a doctor friend of mine always likes to say, he's also my environmental mentor, John Osborne. He always says that the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis. And, you know, if people are asking the wrong questions, they're going to come up with the wrong answers. And it seems to me that what you're doing is just incredibly important of casting about and attempting to figure out what the right questions are, which seems to me is the first step.
Yeah. I have, you know, what I really struggle with myself is you know, maintaining a positive attitude and trying, you know, it's hard to get up sometimes.
Well, I think
I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, every moment of every day. You know,
Yeah, sorry.
I saw this beautiful golden-crowned kinglet a couple days ago. It's a bird who you don't see them very often, although there's 100 million in the United States. You don't see them very often because they live in the tops of trees, and this one happened to be down by the ground. And so I looked it up, and there's still a lot of them, 100 million, but it also their population is going down by 2.5% per year. And this is true no matter who you're talking about, you know, whether we're talking about the red-legged frogs you mentioned or anybody else. I mean, the world's being killed, and of course it's hard to get up if you're actually a living being. And we have about a minute left. And what do you want to say in your last minute to we don't need to go away from the sorrow, we don't need to go into the sorrow. It's whatever you want to say to sort of sum up and what do you want people to take away?
Well, you know, I really feel like the people in the transition movement that perhaps will listen to this interview, is I really feel like we need to ramp the movement up. We need to get the other people who are not represented in the room. I think we need to, you know, get the voice of the living creatures in the room. And I think that, you know, we need to acknowledge that we need to build a culture of resistance, that weaving together the people is a start towards a common cause, but that we actually need to get to the core of our issues and problems. And, you know, I mean, like I said just a minute ago, the question is, do we do something or do we do nothing? Do we fight or do we submit to power? You know, do we get to the roots of the problem or do we continue to just dabble at the surface? I do believe that transition is doing something. And, you know, and I think it's very important, and that some of its processes and projects do actually have the power to break through the denial and consent of our culture, which are the tools of oppression. And so, I want to leave with that message that, you know, transition is a very good thing. I just think it's time it moved on to the next level, deepened into transition 3.0, if you like.
Well, thank you so much. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Raven Gray. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. Ooh.